Welcome to The Last American Vagabond. I have an extra special show for you today, something that is very important regarding foreign policy, a topic that is being very aggressively misrepresented today, as always. But interestingly enough, today the focus is not just the mainstream media misinformation, but that also coming from the independent media and how this is misrepresenting a very serious situation that, as I've said many times before, whether we're talking COVID-19 or things before this, is very it's an integral part of this entire deception that I see happening that involves foreign policy, domestic policy, everything that's going on today. And it stems back to a lot of larger agendas. So joining me today, my honor to have all three of them on the same show today, is Kovorik Almasian, Ava Bartlett, and Vanessa Beely, all here today to discuss this topic primarily around Syria and wherever else we decide to go with that. So thank you all of you for joining me today. How are all of you simultaneously?
Good.
Doing fine.
A pleasure to have you all on, especially Kovorik, you as well, since this is the first time we've actually had an in-person meeting. So it's fantastic to have you on.
It's my pleasure to be on your show, my friend.
Hey, thank you for joining me. So there's a lot to get into around Syria specifically. And I think where we should start on this is right in the meat of this topic that has been very frustrating for myself. And I can't even imagine for the three of you, which I very much consider experts on the topic. And this is not just around the recent election, but a lot of misinformation that seems to be digging up a lot of these old, what, you know, we can call them debunked, which I obviously think they are, but just old claims that have been shown to be at the very least undefined by actual data around Assad himself, around Syria itself, around what's really going on there, around the illegal occupation. So let's start off with what you guys are currently seeing today, both mainstream and independent, that you feel is aggressively misrepresenting the situation and why we wanted to have this show today. Why don't we start off with Kovorik, since this is the first time we've had you on?
Thank you very much, first of all, for having me. It's a really pleasure to be on your show. Actually, one of the main misconceptions about Syria is how to put this conflict into proper context, right? So if we want to see this issue from a domestic perspective, that it is a so-called revolution against a dictatorship, then people will say, or so-called journalists, those who are working in the mainstream media and some of the journals in the alternative media, that if this is a revolution against dictatorship, then the actions or the reactions of the government against any kind of dissent against it, it should be considered as some sort of a civil war, or Assad is murdering his own people. And this is what the perception, the general perception that we have been fed in the past 11 years for now. However, it was very fast that it was very easy to debunk this narrative, especially that we have learned since the first few weeks and few months of the, the rebellion against the government, that these groups are receiving tons of weapons, ammunition, and funding. So willingly, these groups who are fighting against Assad, whether politically or through military means, they have become tools. And to whom they have become tools? They have become tools for the United States, which is the biggest supporter of these groups in Syria, whether political groups or military groups. And then comes some of the regional countries, namely Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and other regional governments who are very rich countries, let's say. So all these countries investing in this conflict in Syria in order to remove the president or dismantle the current political system there is not about democracy. Like, no government will invest billions of dollars in Syria in order to export the so-called democracy, right? They have their own geopolitical interest. The current system since the 60s and especially since the 70s, positioned itself in the axis of resistance in the region, and they have been opposing the foreign policy of the United States and particularly Israel in the region. Therefore, all this investment in this political or the armed groups in Syria, it has a major goal, which is to change the behavior of the current system, or to change it completely, like the system completely, to crumble it and then build another system as they did in Iraq and in Libya. So if we see this conflict from a geopolitical perspective, we will understand that this is an imperialist war against Syria. And if it's an imperialist war against Syria, the actions or even the reactions of the government against these groups should be considered as an action against the tools of the imperialists. So when you put it into proper context, you understand that any action the government is taking against these groups is basically against the backers and the sponsors and the godfathers of these groups. And we are talking about major imperialist powers. We are talking about the United States, the UK, France, the Netherlands. And today I was reading an article about Sweden's role in Syria. They have exported over 400 jihadists in Syria, right? So if you say this is an imperialist war, and at the same time you're also saying that Assad is murdering his own people, you're already contradicting yourself. And in order to simplify this, the example of Guaido. If Guaido in Venezuela forms a battalion or an armed group, and he fights against the Maduro government, and if the Maduro government shoots against this group, you can't consider this as Maduro killing his own people, because Guaido himself, first of all, it's not legitimate to find any armed group to fight against the government. This is one. And secondly, if Guaido is receiving all the funding and the weaponry from the United States, then Guaido is fighting the United States on its own soil, whereas the United States is conducting a fourth generation of asymmetrical warfare. It's a proxy. It's fighting the Venezuelan people through proxies, right? So all these details we have to really address before we even dare to, because it's easy nowadays to claim to be a pundit, claim to be a journalist, and just tweet anything you want or say anything you want. And in the past 11 years, it went unchecked. But now, I'm sorry, there are many people on social media. They are following you. They are reading you. They are watching your videos. So when you claim that Syria is a police state or it's a brutal dictatorship, you have to expect for the real experts who were underground, who have put their lives in danger, like real danger, not like going to Syria and cruising with a bus or something, then maybe you can evaluate the political system in Syria, but not when you have been absent in the past 7-8 years and you remembered Syria in the past 3 years, and now all of a sudden you want to participate in the construction of the narratives, because any word you say on social media, it has an impact. People need to understand this, especially if the platform is big. And when the United States is using this narrative, saying there is a brutal dictatorship, we have to remove him, and you are repeating that the same claim, that means you're participating in the legitimatization of the U.S. War against Syria. This is my humble opinion about it.
Yes, I agree. And it's an interesting point to make that, of course, the Geneva Conventions, the United Nations has always maintained that illegal occupations or peoples of an illegal occupation have the right to armed rebellion. So it's a very valid point to make in the way that they frame this as, you know, this is the constant we see is this misrepresentation of the reality and politics drive the discussion. Well, let's go to Vanessa Bealey next on her opinion of where we are in the situation regarding Syria and the misinformation that's being spread today around the topic.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Kivork has made some incredibly pertinent points, not only tonight, but in various interviews that he's done over the last week, for which, you know, personally, I'm very grateful, because it's enabled him to bring these points to the table to people that have probably been deprived of these points. And why have they been deprived of these points? Because, unfortunately, as you pointed out in the beginning, even among the so-called left, such as it is these days, but the anti-imperialist media bloc, the independent media bloc, we are seeing the use of this terminology that although they may be defending one aspect of the imperialist hybrid war against Syria that has been ongoing for 10 years, but of course was concocted in the halls of MI6 and CIA long before 2011. And when we see them, so that they'll defend one aspect of the war against Syria, and they will do a very good job at exposing certain aspects of the war against Syria. But unfortunately, when they then, if you like, bring up the CIA and MI6 talking points that effectively started the war against Syria and have sustained the war against Syria and will potentially be used to sustain sanctions against Syria, to sustain the blockade of Syria, to sustain the criminalization of the allies of Syria, and potentially in the future to sustain future unrest, future uprisings. You know, the US is not known for letting go of its prey. So we have to assume that there are future projects designed to further destabilize Syria, to further economically fragment Syria, to further put pressure on the neighbors, on the friendly neighbors of Syria, like, for example, Lebanon. So in my view, it is highly irresponsible to be maintaining the narratives that, if you like, enable the continuation of some degree of collective punishment of the Syrian people, because that's effectively what is the result. And when those talking points are regurgitated without any context whatsoever, right, by commentators and analysts, the majority of whom have not spent, as Kivork mentioned, any time whatsoever inside Syria, they have not experienced the actual war inside Syria, right? And they haven't, if you like, embedded themselves in this culture, in this civilization, and come to an understanding of this culture and the meaning of democracy to Syria. The meaning of democracy to Syria is bloodshed, in a nutshell, right? And to, if you like, project American or UK or EU version of democracy, which I would claim, particularly since March 2020, is being exposed as ridiculous. We don't have democracy in the West, and here we are trying to impose it upon a country that effectively, under its own constitutional governance, is behaving in a more democratic fashion than any of our regimes, any of our countries, any of our police forces are doing right now. So I think for me, what is severely lacking in this entire subject is debate. All of these so-called anti-imperialist analysts are effectively seemingly to continuing to speak to an echo chamber. In other words, they're not allowing diverging views into their echo chamber. They're not debating people that would question their conclusions, one. And two, they are presenting these conclusions to their audiences. And as Kivork said, you know, some of them have very big platforms. They have a lot of influence. So they are presenting these conclusions to their audiences with zero context. They haven't mentioned the fact that Syria has been the target of a number of destabilization attempts, coup d'etat, fomented unrest in the 70s and 80s, for example. It has been consistently a target of the West for both government change, destabilization, resource plundering, sanctions, since its independence from France in 1946. It hasn't stopped for Syria. But this is never really presented. No context is given to the conclusions that are drawn, and therefore the audience is left basically believing what the media has been telling them about Syria for the last 10 years. And this is really, in my view, this is borderline criminal, because what it's doing is, as I said, sustaining the war against Syria, sustaining the poverty, bloodshed, and misery for the Syrian people. And it's not journalism. This is protection of a brand, but both on the anti-imperialist sector and in mainstream media. Of course, in mainstream media, we know why they're maintaining these talking points and actually ratcheting them up right now, because they've lost the military war, so now it's an information war, and the information war now is probably more virulent, more savage than it was during the military war. And so therefore, we have a responsibility as journalists not to simply say the opposite, but to do the research to see if what we're saying is actually true, or if we should be offering context to back up what we're saying.
Absolutely agree. And that is such an important point that goes far beyond this topic in foreign policy. We're at a point in the world today where, like you talked about, shutting down debate. No honest researcher, journalist, pundit, anything would be shutting down debate regardless of how contentious or something they disagree with if they actually want an objective conversation. And it always funnels back to the point of trust, where people today, whether mainstream or independent alike, are basically putting out content, text, no backup source material, and just saying, well, trust us based on our brand. Exactly. And that's not real journalism. That's not real research. Yeah. And this is what bothers me in the sphere, again, independent and mainstream alike. So let's jump over to Eva Bartlett. Let's see what your thoughts are, and then we'll jump into some questions.
Sure. And I'll just apologize. My internet cut. So I hope I don't repeat anything that Kaver Kovanessa said. But I did want to touch on some points that I did hear Kaborg making. So regarding the whole concept that is still pushed by some in the anti-imperialist media bloc, that the president is a dictator, or that the elections are a fraud, or that the whole theme of him killing his own people, these same people, to my knowledge, I haven't seen them express any concern for the terrorism and the suffering that Syrians have endured since the start of this war against Syria. And I'm sure you're very aware, and your viewers are aware, that Syrians have been excluded. And when I say Syrians, I mean the vast majority of Syrians who are living not only in government-controlled areas, but also areas controlled by the terrorist factions. Their suffering was completely excluded from media reporting over the past decade. So, you know, that's suffering of Syrians in government-controlled Aleppo, in Damascus, being pummeled with a variety of bombs sent by the terrorists, or Syrians living besieged areas, formerly besieged areas like Afu and Kafraya in Idlib, or Nubal and Zahra in Aleppo province. Suffering greatly, actually being starved, being bombed, being denied medical treatment by these terrorist factions. And Kaborg was speaking of collective punishment. This collective punishment was being actively ignored and downplayed by corporate media, that if they deigned to mention it, they would mention it was a Shia stronghold or an Alawi stronghold or something like that. Making their suffering seem irrelevant. And so back to this theme of, you know, Assad is killing his people, or any of those other CIA talking points, when you're saying this kind of thing, you're whitewashing the crimes against the Syrian people of these terrorist factions. The other point is also that I don't know if Kaborg or Vanessa touched on this, I'm sure they might have, but you know, the Syrian army doesn't comprise one sect, it comprises, it's an army of the nation of Syria. So it's people of all faiths from all over Syria. So you'll have the Syrian army members that had family members in areas like Eastern Ghouta or in Idlib. And so this whole concept of, you know, Assad and his army are killing its people, it shows a great degree of ignorance, because you're just showing you don't realize that the Syrian army, again, has loved ones in the areas that they're trying to liberate from these terrorist factions. So I think, you know, it is a caveat that we hear many pundits, whether they're whether they've been in the media game for a while and used to promote the very lies that corporate media continues to promote on Syria, or whether they're new to the game and they feel they need to utter these caveats in order to establish credibility. No, you establish credibility by actually, I think Vanessa was saying something to this effect, you know, by actually asking the questions like, am I actually considering the angle that we've been told by corporate media? Am I actually asking questions, or am I just going along with this narrative in order to fit in and get my street cred? The other thing in terms of the talking points that are still, like, after the elections, being pushed is this mocking of the fact that the president is actually extremely popular in Syria for a variety of reasons, which Kaborg might have already touched on. But, you know, 10 years of war against the Syrian people and these pundits that say, you know, the elections were a fraud or a scam, they just don't seem to realize, number one, how stupid they sound, and number two, how much support the president does have and why he has that support. And again, the Syrian people are not stupid. You can run into a random Syrian in Homs or in Aleppo and they'll tell you, very well what they know to be the reason for the war on Syria. They know what it's about. They don't believe it's about democracy or any other nonsense that's been pushed by Western media and pundits. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. Brian, would you mind popping back in so I can see you?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll just add to one of your points in regard to the credibility. This is something that I keep pointing out, that there's an aspect of independent media that is more driven, in my opinion, by the business as opposed to fighting for the truth, and that you gain the credibility, which is mainstream media credibility, by leaning into the points you're talking about. And this is the kind of thing we've heard in the past. Well, oh, he's definitely a dictator, but it's like, well, wait a minute. And this is the frustrating part about this, because, you know, there's no real evidence other than coming from intelligence community inside unnamed individuals from the government that are making these claims. And the reality on the ground, as you guys have pointed out, is quite opposite. But to say that is, in my opinion, very weak journalism, if that at all. As you know, it's about things that people don't want uncovered, not just towing the line. That's not journalism, right? That's propaganda. But if you had anything else you wanted to add, I can jump over into some questions for everybody.
Sure. No, I remember the point I was making when I was saying that, you know, your average Syrian has a very good understanding of what this war on Syria is really about. And so when we come back to the question of Assad's popularity, it's not only because perhaps they think he's a gentle man, an educated man, which is what you will hear quite often from Syrians, but it's also because he stood with the country, stood for the country, did not leave the country. And he, along with Syria's allies, have defeated, you know, some of the most powerful forces in the world. And so Syrians, I believe Kay Bork in a recent interview said this very eloquently, Syrians are in voting for Assad, whether it's because they really love the guy, or it's because they know that Syria has shown the world that it has defeated the terrorism, and that they don't want what the West is trying to impose on Syria. So when you're doubting, you know, the legitimacy of the elections, supremely ironic coming from Americans, I must say, you're not even taking into context this decade of war and what the Syrians have fought for and won.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. And it just comes down to misrepresentation based on a lack of evidence. And before we jump into some questions, I want to start with the election. I just like to ask in general, like in regard to the claims around, let's just say, the concept of he's a brutal dictator, or even before we get into the election and how it's undemocratic, what is the basis of evidence that's being laid out for those claims? Is there anything that actually leads to that, or is this coming from intelligence from the United States, from the governments, or what are your thoughts on that? Anyone who wants to begin?
I mean, one of the reports that has been published in 2018, I believe, by the Amnesty International, or 2019, that Assad has murdered over 13,000 prisoners in Setnaya prison, etc. So this report has been used and circled a lot among whether alternative or the mainstream media. And the people, they don't really dig into this report because they just read either the titles or read about it on any mainstream media outlet, because they don't show you, if you read on CNN or MSNBC or any other outlet, they will not show you the methodology of the research, right? But if you read the actual report of the, for example, the Amnesty International, and you dig in and read the notes, the side notes, and the methodology that it's been used, there is no way possible for any academic research or research that you're trying to condemn the government of murdering 13,000 people, okay, in a prison, and you're using only interviews with unknown people. It's possible, it may be okay to interview one person or two and say for security reasons, but not the entire document is based on interviews with unknown people residing in Turkey and saying that, claiming that they were in the prison or they have someone in the prison. That doesn't work that way. The same thing is for the Caesar Act, because the Caesar Act was one of the harshest sanctions by the United States on Syria. And who is Caesar? Nobody knows him. He's like always hiding his face, and nobody knows who is this guy. So once Eva, in one of her interventions, I think in the UN, she said, once or twice when you quote an unknown activist, that could be okay. But if you're basing your entire narrative on unknown activists or unknown people that we can't even see their faces, I mean, how can we trust such reports, right? And even the Human Rights Watch admitted regarding the the Caesar guy who supposedly collected photos from Syria, that half of the photos were for the murdered Syrian army soldiers. So if half the photos that he's presenting and claiming that these are people who were murdered by the Syrian government have been proven that they belong to Syrian army soldiers, how can I believe the other half is about the Syrian government torturing people? And there are many reports and documents, similar documents and reports that have been published in the past years. And these guys, they didn't went through these documents because they are touching the surface of the issues and not the core of the issues. And I want to mention also, just if I want to jump back a little bit in history, people treat the Syrian crisis as if it started in 2011. Okay. Today, when I was reading about this, there is a new report about how Sweden sent over 400 jihadists to Syria. It was surprising for me to read that Sweden was also taking part of it. And I was reading some of the names. One of the guys who traveled to Syria, his name is Tarif Sayed Al-Isa from Sweden in 2015, all the way to Syria in Idlib to fight against the government. And he joined Al-Nusra Front, okay? And in a very basic research in the internet, in the Arabic, you can find that this guy was already fighting in the 80s against the Syrian government in the Muslim Brotherhood battalion called the Fighting Vanguard. And I started to check his family. And one of his family members, his name is Yasser Sayed. And Yasser Sayed is a famous political activist in Sweden, and he's a regular guest on Swedish public TVs, and he's giving excuses for the jihadists who are traveling to Syria to murder the Syrian people. And I tried also to search if he has other family members, and I found out that he's the brother of Fidas Sayed, and Fidas Sayed is the guy who established the Syrian Revolution Facebook and Twitter account. So it's a complete network of people who were working since the 80s when the first rebellion happened of the Muslim Brotherhood against the Syrian government. And this is very important. Why the rebellion happened of the Muslim Brotherhood against the Syrian government in between 79 and 82? The main reason was because after this 1973 war between Syria, Egypt, and Israel, where Syria and Egypt tried to liberate their occupied territories, when the war was over, Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, he jumped on the wagon of the negotiations very fast, and he accepted a surrender deal. Like, they call it a peace treaty, I call it a surrender treaty with Israel. And the Americans lobbied and pressured on the Syrian government to accept such a deal. And Hafez al-Assad refused back then in 78. And he said, any deal with Israel should be comprehensive. It should be just peace and a comprehensive deal between all the Arabic nations with Israel, if Israel withdraws from all the occupied territories. So when Syria refused to sign on a treaty, in 79, the rebellion erupted in Syria. It was just like a year later of the so-called peace treaty that Syria refused, and the rebellion erupted in Syria. And I was reading, I have made actually 6 videos about the Muslim Brotherhood and focused on the Muslim Brotherhood rebellion in the 80s. And I was shocked, because I thought it's a new thing that in 2011, all these Muslim Brotherhood guys are residing in Europe and having their offices, media offices. And I was like, what the F? They already had offices in the 80s in Germany, in Brussels, and they had the media, like they had newspapers and they had media outlets, they had radios, and they had the political coordination groups here in Europe. So this is nothing new for Syria.
Right.
It didn't start in 2011, this Islamist Muslim Brotherhood rebellion, or what they call it, a revolution against Syria. But the people, they start to address the Syrian issue from 2011. It's a short-sighted analysis. That is why people who call themselves pundits, and when you listen to them, they look like a fool on media. But it's really, really sad to see in the alternative media people trying to make like like gangs. Like they're just having themselves and their own narratives, and they don't want to broaden that horizon of the narrative. Mm-hmm. They don't want to bring new people in. Like, I'm sorry, my work is very, very humble. It's very humble in the past years, but it's not possible for these so-called alternative medias not to host me at all. Like, there should be a reason why you don't want to host me or talk to me or try to listen to me, right? Yeah, so why are they trying to keep, like, to limit this argument, you know?
I think that's pretty apparent in general, in my opinion. But I think, you know, you or plenty of others in the same sphere that are people that are on the ground or have been or understand the situation in a different, or at the very least have a differing opinion, right? That's what actual journalism is supposed to be, giving you all sides of, you know, multiple sides. I think to bring it back to what you were saying, it's, you know, it all stems back from a long time ago to even to this day, pointing to people as, you know, whether it's intelligence agencies, unknown people, or people you were just referencing, to then make the claims they're continuing to make that still argue that this is what they've been saying this entire time. And basically it's rooted in things that are not defined, that are not evidence, in my opinion. It's claims being made by people who have an investment in the narrative. And that's ridiculous. Now, that doesn't mean it's automatically false, but it means that if all you're doing is continuing to throw those same things out there without verifying them, it doesn't mean anything. That report doesn't mean anything. It's meaningless without the source material. And that's what everyone's beginning to wake up to with everything happening today. So why don't let you guys have any comments on what he said. Why don't we bring it into the election?
I would just make a very short absolutely. Statement. These people, they don't even reply on Twitter. When you write or make a comment, they just ignore you. Like, they don't want to host you, but at the same time, they don't also want to engage in a discussion on Twitter. They engage only with the famous checkmark people and from the mainstream media. But if somebody comes like me from an alternative media and from a Syrian background and trying to point out, like, giving some comments, right? They don't engage in, because their narrative will crumble very fast if they engage in a discussion.
Totally agree.
If I can just pop in and just make one point also about the, and I'm sure Eva's probably got something to say about the Caesar sanctions and also about the Sadnaya report. Look, if these anti-imperialist media pundits are debunking a particular narrative, and they're doing a pretty good job of this one narrative. But the interesting thing, I mean, we've had such a raft of evidence that, for example, the UK Foreign Office document leak showing the $1 million black op project against Syria, funding outreach agents to provide media and PR for violent extremist armed groups that carried out war crimes and atrocities and ethnic cleansing programs against the Syrian people. If that alone doesn't trigger them to question what they're being told by the mainstream media, because all of the narratives that they are repeating come from the mainstream media. They don't come from elsewhere. They don't come from inside Syria, except from the voices that are being amplified by the mainstream media. If you spend time in Syria, almost everybody, even those in opposition to the government but who didn't take up arms, will challenge those kind of conclusions. But those people aren't spoken to. Syrians like Kevork are not given a platform. Syrians that will give diverging views are not given a platform. So I'm sorry, these anti-imperialist pundits are no different to the mainstream media, because they're deplatforming voices that would challenge their own conclusions. Why? Because they want to keep the debate at this reductionist level, which protects their brand, gives them credibility in that mainstream consensus, right? But it doesn't develop the argument. It doesn't help the Syrian people, actually. That's the bottom line. That's what we all should be focusing on, is defending the sovereignty of Syria, its territorial integrity, and its people's self-determination. And if you're not giving them a voice, then you're not doing that. You're failing. And you basically, this is dereliction of duty as a journalist, in my opinion, because you're no longer talking truth to power. You're succumbing to power narratives in order to protect yourself while, let's say, cherry-picking the stories that are going to up your brand, give you credibility, give you a bigger audience. That's my view. But coming back quickly to the CSER report itself was commissioned by Qatar, which, let's face it, was probably the single biggest financier of Al-Qaeda inside Syria, number one. Number two, the Saidnaya report. Former inmates of Saidnaya actually discredited that Amnesty International report. Kivork and I actually spoke about that. There were actual former inmates that said there are no political prisoners inside Saidnaya. They are all hardcore extremists. And let's go back to pre-2011 very quickly. In a 2004, I think, Guardian article, an opposition lawyer, Anwar Bunni, actually said, he recorded this, that there were around 1,000 to 1,500 political prisoners, the majority of which dated from the late 70s and early 80s, when there was an externally fomented Muslim Brotherhood uprising against the government of Hafez al-Assad, the father of Bashar al-Assad. So these, of course, in Western narratives are called political prisoners. In Syria, the majority of people you would speak to on the street would call them the extremists that carried out car bombs, attacks on civilians, that massacred Syrian army cadets in Aleppo, that carried out all manner of atrocities against the Syrian people, that has completely disappeared from Western narratives. Now, Bashar al-Assad in 2004 released 800 of those political prisoners, right? And at that point, so pre-2011, the majority of reports, including from Amnesty International, said there were around 200 political prisoners, although we can argue over the terminology political prisoner also, in Syrian prisons. You know, this isn't the kind of 500,000 that we're being taught. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but this isn't the kind of draconian. I mean, let's look at Saudi Arabia. Let's look at Israel. Let's look at Egypt. Let's look at every single ally, every single despot that works with the US, but is never called out for its human rights violations. Saudi Arabia has the worst record of human rights violations and imprisonment of political prisoners. Israel, right? You know, but Syria that had around 200 political prisoners, and as I said, the terminology political prisoner can be argued over, right? And post-war, there's a very strong chance that the majority of political prisoners are hardcore Al-Qaeda-affiliated extremists. Because let's not forget, under the Amnesty and Reconciliation brought in by the brutal dictator, President Bashar al-Assad, Syrians that took up arms against their country are given amnesty if they surrender. They cannot be prosecuted in court unless a civilian brings a case against them. So they are effectively forgiven and reintegrated back into Syrian society unless a civilian wants to take a case against them for a crime they committed against that civilian or their family. Please show me one American president or one UK regime or one US coalition regime that would show that level of leniency to its own civilians that have taken up arms and committed atrocities against other civilians inside Syria.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I mean, it comes down to the misrepresentation of the information on the ground, which is always what's happening. And it's something that is nonstop. And people that are parroting that information are only hurting the overall objective, as pointed out, which is the people on the ground that we're trying to give a voice to that don't have a voice. Eva, did you have any points on that before we went to just the election in general?
No, I mean, I'm really glad that Vanessa brought that up. And just on both of what Vanessa and K-Work were saying about, you know, pushing this brand and ignoring certain things, well, most things, while you're focusing on this one point, I would just add, like, not only is it poor journalism, but it's moral cowardice, right? If you feel the need to repeat these talking points to establish your credibility while ignoring voices like voices within Syria or voices like K-Work, who's been, in my mind, one of the most solid sources of excellent information on Syria for the past decade. So if they're avoiding talking to people like K-Work or people within Syria that would offer a different understanding of the army, of the president, of facts on the ground, then that is moral cowardice. So I just wanted to emphasize that.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I, one of the things that always stands out to me, just a side note, is how you will see, and I've seen more times than I can count, where Assad will go out into a huge crowd of people and just wander into people. You will never see that happen in these Western countries. And, you know, people could argue it's orchestrated or whatever, but at the end of the day, the evidence is quite clear on that. And I found that to always be a really glaring point that seems to differ from what we see here, where they're protected behind their walls and armed guns in their capital, where it's a little different than what we see here, in this discussion. Well, let's bring this into the discussion of the election, because that's one that I always found to be it's a very obvious one, even for people that aren't involved in immersed in the information. You know, we see this happen in Bolivia, in Venezuela, the same kind of thing. Now, regardless of what ultimately happens on the ground, what's proven, independent monitors from around the world, all they need to say is it's fake, they cheated, and just yell that out and just continue to drive that in and push it in, and try to use that as a tool against these governments that evidence seems to suggest the people actually voted for, which in their narrative would be democracy. So let's go ahead and start with Vanessa on your thoughts on the election in general and how it's being misrepresented in the independent media and what you're actually seeing from the ground.
Yeah, I mean, Eva and I were both in Damascus. I also spent some time leading up to the elections, visiting areas that had actually previously been occupied by terrorist groups. And seeing the kind of pre-election celebrations in these areas, and of course the president himself went to vote in Douma, the scene of the Jaish al-Islam and White Helmet orchestrated chemical attack in 2018, which again, for me, this election was full of messages and messages to the West. This was what was so important about it, because living in Syria and leading up to the elections, I had seen how depressed the Syrian people were. You know, our electricity, I mean, yesterday, I think I had 1 hour electricity in 48 degrees heat. And that's the same throughout Damascus yesterday. It was a disaster. And so leading up to the elections, people had been really suffering, you know, rising food prices, biting sanctions, no electricity, no fuel, no gas, et cetera, et cetera. They were living a very suppressed, deprived life. The 80% were below poverty levels. And really, I was shocked by the level of enthusiasm, both before and during the election. And for me, this was one of the most uplifting moments. I don't know. I think Eva probably felt the same in the whole war, because after everything, after 10 years war, after everything that America had thrown at Syria, an information war, a hybrid war, a war of attrition, a propaganda war, a war of starvation, of burning of crops, occupation of civilian infrastructure, destruction of hospitals, etc., millions of Syrians went out on the streets and partied. And this was not about the election of President Assad. This was a message to the West to say, you're irrelevant. Your opinion of our people, your opinion of our president, your opinion of our choice, of our election process is irrelevant, right? That's exactly how I felt. It was just, whatever you do, we are going to defend everything that to us represents Syria. And our president, who has stayed in the country, who has provided stability, who has continued to provide healthcare, food, subsidized food, water, electricity, despite the occupation of all of these resources by terrorist groups, US proxies, he has still enabled his civilians to survive and live a life of dignity. There is no world leader today that I think could have achieved what he achieved during those 10 years under the level of pressure that this country has been under. And he provided stability. He provided stability and he provided solidarity with his people. And that is what, for me, this whole election was about. And it really punched home to me the strength and resilience and courage of the Syrian people and the absolute moral depravity of Western regimes that are effectively persecuting these people who have greater civilization, greater culture, greater wisdom than they will ever have.
Yeah. The government actions, I was going to add real quick, the government actions themselves from Assad's administration during this process very clearly show the opposite of what they try to paint it as, just aimlessly killing people for no reason. I mean, they've taken actions left and right that even, as you guys have all pointed out, the channels, that's the wrong term, I believe, but the where they give people the channels to be able to evacuate certain areas. And that includes the people that's funded by outside procs or outside sources. So it just very clearly misrepresents that. And it's very frustrating to see. And this is all about sovereignty at the end of the day. And that's what I love about your point there, Vanessa, is that they're coming out and saying, look, you have no right to say what we have to accept, what we should want, and how we should live our lives. And that's a powerful moment. And of course, surprise, surprise, the Western media ignored it entirely because it challenged the narrative, right?
Could I jump in to make a point? And I won't be long because I really would like KVORK to speak a lot about this. But just to piggyback on what Vanessa was saying, it was extremely momentous and moving to be there during and after the elections. Being in Duma, although not at the same time as the president, was incredibly moving. We're all aware, but maybe viewers aren't aware of just how hellish life was for the people of Duma and all of Eastern Ghouta under the rule of Jaish al-Islam and the other terrorist groups. And, you know, when we were there, Vanessa and I and other people were there seeing not just men cheering, but young, beautiful young Syrian women cheering and dancing. They could never have done that under the rule of these terrorists that were bringing democracy to Syria. So that was very poignant to see. It was extremely moving to see the celebrations in Umayyad Square, which is a central Damascus square. The moment that the election results were announced, it was just crazy electricity, really, really moving to be there. But what I did want to just say is that, you know, in 2014, I was in Lebanon. I was waiting for my first journalist visa, and I was really bummed that I couldn't be in Syria during those elections. I had just been in Syria, and so as I said, I was waiting to see if I could get a journalist visa, and I actually did get one. So what I did during the elections then is to go to the Syrian embassy in just outside in Beirut, but outside of the hub of Beirut. So to get there, normally you could take a taxi or something. I took a bus. I ended up meeting some Syrians along the way, chatting with them. The bus stopped about 4 or 5 kilometers before the embassy because the road was clogged with vehicles going that way. And we ended up walking in the late May heat to the embassy, where around the embassy you had just, I don't even know the numbers, but I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, KVORK and Vanessa, if it was tens of thousands of Syrians that came out to vote. The embassy was scheduled to close. It was open, I believe, at 7. It was scheduled to close at 7. It stayed open until midnight to accommodate all the voters. And then it opened a second day for that same amount of time. So this brings me to my point about what Western pundits will say about why the elections are, quote unquote, a sham. They will say Syrians were forced to vote. Well, if they're in, quote unquote, regime areas, they were forced to vote. You know, but here I was in Lebanon and KVORK at the same time, and these people were not forced to vote. They were fighting to get to the embassy to vote. And then the other point I would make was just a week later, I was in Syria, and I ended up going to Homs, and I was in the old city of Homs, which had been liberated, I think, a month prior. And there was still a party raging a week after the fact. There was still a party raging for the elections. So then back to 2021, as I was talking about how poignant it was, you know, however many 7 years on and Syria has defeated this terrorism. It was a very momentous time. But the other thing I'm just going to make quickly is that contrary to the whole forced to vote thing, then pundits will say, well, Syrians in Idlib can't vote, right? Well, that's not the fault of the Syrian government. And we know that every time an area has been occupied by terrorists, the Syrian government and its allies and the Russians have opened corridors to enable civilians to flee. And time and again, every single time, it's the terrorists who shell the corridors, including times when both Vanessa and myself have been there to witness the exit of civilians. So this whole concept of blaming the government for Syrians in Idlib, for example, not being able to vote is just completely ridiculous. But at the same time, I didn't hear a whole lot of pundits talking about the fact that Canada and the US and Germany made it impossible for Syrians to vote. Canada and the US closing embassies, and Kevork can talk about Germany. But, you know, you have all these Syrians in countries that closed Syrian embassies who wanted to vote. Many of them could not. Those who could afford to come to Syria to vote did so. And we know with the COVID travel restrictions, many couldn't do so. So, I mean, if you want to talk about people not allowing Syrians to vote, please, please talk about this criminal closure of Syrian embassies. But Kevork, I'd like to pass it on to you, and maybe you can talk about how it was in Germany and why perhaps Syrians couldn't vote there.
One quick point, Kevork, before we pass it to you, I just want to add to the hypocrisy of what you were describing there, that in Venezuela, for instance, we saw the example where they were pointing to Maduro's turnout and saying, you know, despite the 30 independent observers that said it was fair, they pointed to him and said, no, you didn't have enough voter turnout. And one other metric I forget about. And simultaneously, France and Macron had a lower voter turnout and lower of all the metrics they were pointing out. But of course, they don't point that out in the good guy nations, right? It's you can't make that argument and then have it happening in your own home. It's hypocrisy. So please go ahead, Kevork.
The funny thing about Germany was the government was following the reactions, if the people are going to vote or not. So they didn't make any statement about it until like 2 days before the elections. And 2 days before the elections, the Syrians were already organized themselves, and they have rented buses to come from all over Germany, from different federal states. And they were like thousands of people coming to Berlin to vote. And this could be seen as a scandal for the German government, because for the past 10 years, also the German government is in the same wagon of the regime change. And not only that, in order to convince the people of Germany to accept around the million Syrian refugees, the initial argument was like they're fleeing the Hitler of the 21st century, and they are fleeing from the massacres of that one insane guy who's driving his own tanks and he's shelling the people indiscriminately, and he has murdered over 500,000 people, so we have to accept. So this is how they indoctrinate the people. But if the same Syrian refugees and the community of the Syrians who live in Germany go and vote for Bashar al-Assad with thousands of people, and the media comes and cover that, that would be seen as a slap in the face of the German government. So they were like, 2 days before the election, they say, elections are banned. And it's criminal, it's illegal to ban any community to participate in the elections. But why would they do that 48 hours before the election? Because you're not able to take any legal action against the government, right? You don't have time, and you need also resources to have a good lawyer and appeal against the decision. So they were playing on time, and they played a very dirty game. But during the day of the elections, we managed to gather some hundreds of Syrians in front of the embassy, and we did our like symbolic elections, not the real elections, but we just wanted to show the people that we're here and we want to cast our votes, but you banned that. And the other side, they mobilized. The other side, when I say the side that supports the FSR and all the terrorist groups, and so they have platforms that are funded by the German taxpayers, right? Like these people have NGOs behind them. They have a lot of scholarships and funding. And despite that, they couldn't mobilize people. Like they were less than 50 people, less than 50 people the other side. And I tried even to point out to on Twitter and wanted to catch the attention of the German police. Some of these people who were on the other side, they were carrying pictures of ex-ISIS fighter. His name is Abdelbaset Sarut. And they are carrying his picture as he is some sort of an icon of the Syrian revolution. And he is a democratic guy. And this guy, he used to song to sing songs about how he wants to exterminate the minorities in Syria. Like, we're coming to you with our knives. And he has very famous songs. And these guys are walking free in Germany. And unfortunately, when I point out to this sort of mentalities that exist among the Syrian refugees, and I call them infiltrators. And I'm not saying the refugees are like this. I'm saying the infiltrators in the refugees. You are automatically categorized as being a neo-Nazi, fascist, and self-hating Syrian, and blah, blah, blah. So it's a really hard situation in Germany. And Germany is like, they climbed the tree and they're not able to get down now. And you don't really understand why Germany is opposing Syria. They don't even have an interest in opposing Syria. They don't have a financial interest. They don't have an ideological interest. There's nothing. They're just following the United States, and they're not able to back off now. So they don't want to open any, ties with Syria again. But I just want to mention something about the elections in Syria, because if I were working as an advisor for Assad, and I'm as an advisor who's trying to build the strongman image of Assad. I'm going to show the people that he's the strong guy. He's the dictator. He's the guy who owns everything. He's the guy who can do everything. So on the constitutional oath day, when he held his speech, they gave this really Caesar-like picture of him. He's this strong guy, and he's walking inside with his wife, and he took his oath, and he said very strong words, and he left. At night, he went to Al-Midan area. And for those who don't know Midan area, Midan is a very crowded area. And if you walk there like 5 minutes, you can pass by like 1,000 or 2,000 people walking. It's like a non-stop people, like, it's very crowded. So even if you want to guarantee the security of the president, you're not able to do it. Any measure is not enough to secure the security of the president. So the point here is, if the people do not like him, the people who are advising the president, they will tell him, don't go to Al-Midan area. There could be something. There could be someone who says some bad words to the president or smears him like they do with Macron. They slap him in the face, right? And not only that, if I was the advisor and I don't want him to look casual among the people, because I want to preserve that image in the minds of the people that he's a dictator, I would advise him not to go to Al-Midan area and eat sandwiches among the people with his casual dresses. So even Assad, he's not interested in being looking that tough guy to his people. He during his work, he's the president, but after his work, he wants to show empathy. He wants to show that he's equal to the people. He wants to be among the people. And this is not a new phenomenon. People think that I'm exaggerating, but even before the war, like, we used to see him in Aleppo at least once per month. He used to come because he likes the Aleppo cuisine. And he used to come with the ex-president of Lebanon, Emil Lahoud, to Aleppo for food. So we used to see him walking in the street. It's not like something new for us. So the point is, if he personally didn't feel like he's secured among the people, he won't go alone with his non-bullet proof cars and walking in the middle of Al-Midan. I hope one day, my friend, you can go to Al-Midan and see how crowded is that area and how it's impossible to, even if you send your entire army, you cannot protect the president unless you're protected by the people.
Yeah, that's an interesting
point. Sorry to interrupt, but Kabor, can you just make a point, please, about the, I'm sorry to get sectarian, but about the makeup of Aleppo and of Midan. Is it primarily, Aleppo we know is primarily Sunni. What about Midan?
Midan is overwhelmingly a Sunni area. And the day that the president went to eat his shawarma, it was the 5th or the 6th anniversary of the day that Jaish al-Islam, al-Nusra Front, and other terrorist organizations invaded Damascus through breaking El Midan area. So they invaded from the suburbs to El Midan, and they from Midan, it was their launching the operations, let's say, launch point or something against the government. So this was also a message that he is in El Midan area among his people, and not only among his people, because in especially among the Gulf media outlets, the Gulf media outlets are extremely sectarian. They call him a lot, like all sorts of names, that he is a Shia, he is an Alevi, he is like an infidel, etc., etc. And he went to an area where is an it's all like Sunni people. And the same thing is in Aleppo. People think that this is some sort of a sectarian war, but in Aleppo, till mid-2012, like after 1.5 years of the eruption of the war, there was nothing in the city, like literally nothing. And how Aleppo became a war zone is how Turkey supported the jihadists, including multinational jihadists, in the northern suburbs, and pushed them with their four-wheel trucks, with their PKSs, with their arms and ammunition to invade Aleppo. And in a matter of few days, half of Aleppo has fallen in the hands of the terrorists. And it wasn't like the people were protesting. It was an armed invasion of Aleppo. And it was a very scary moment because I had a family there. And during this time, my brother was kidnapped by this terrorist. So these people did, like, you need to be at least a Syrian or lived in Syria or visited Syria many times to feel the pain of the Syrians and understand these small details. Otherwise, just sitting behind your laptop, you're not doing any journalism. You're just recycling the work of others, and especially Eva's and Vanessa's work, and without giving any credit. Like, I thought that because Eva and Vanessa, they are the first ones who start to write about the white helmets, right, in Syria. And if you go back to their investigation and see what some of the journalists say nowadays in 2021, it's a paraphrasing of their research about Syria, and without giving any credit to them. So it's not only a cowardice, it's not only that they're repeating CIA talking points, but they're also stealing the work of others and claiming that they have figured out something that we already figured out many years ago. And in 2021, with some eye-catching titles, with some silly thumbnails on social media, they are making careers like this. And on YouTube, you can generate money. So it has become some sort of a business for them. They don't care about the Syrian people.
And the information that you're pointing out that they're taking today was the same information that was attacked by those same people previously, which I find to be ridiculous. But the point about the Sunni point, I find very, very relevant. This, as anybody immersed in this topic should really know, this is this, and there's similar crossovers to Iraq as well. But the point being that the sectarian part of the war is there because of the invasion, because of the occupation. As I've pointed out before, I actually don't know where it would be today, but I know before all this, Syria had one of the largest Christian populations in all of the Middle East before all this. And it doesn't make any sense. And this is the point about how, if the information is being put in here by people with an agenda, and if someone's just going to pick those up and parrot them without understanding that that's blatantly not true on the ground, it's not only dishonest, you're hurting the people that you're pretending to protect, which, by the way, is exactly what the US government does all the time, and all the other governments we're mentioning. They pretend we're fighting for those people, and their very actions hurt those people. So let's bring this over to the brutal dictator topic in general, which we've touched on a little bit already, but why that is very clearly untrue based on what we can see on the ground. And, you know, that's not to say that their government hasn't done things people would find wrong, or that they haven't taken actions in some way that people would find criminal. But personally, I don't trust any government. But at the end of the day, what they're claiming is simply not true. And that's what I think is most important. So why don't we start with Kevork and what's your thoughts on why they would be claiming that this person's a brutal dictator, and why you think that's not true, or what your thoughts are on that topic?
Actually, there are several components, but I want to focus on one of these components, which is a lot of people are in the West are Orientalists, and they see things from this perspective. And they are also, like, although they say they're progressives and we are not racist, but they're also racist. Why? Because they perceive the officials or the people in the Middle East as some sort of, they are uneducated or backward people. So they are producing also a vile and crazy, insane person in power. Like, so they treat President Assad as if he's an insane person. He is illogical. He is not balanced. And he's just waking up in the morning thinking, how many people will he kill? This is how they treat, because this is how they see the people in the Middle East, and this is how they are indoctrinated about Syria. And I dare any of these people who have watched a single interview of Assad, and I'm not saying this because he's the president of Syria. President Assad is among the most educated and eloquent presidents in the Arab world, and not only in the Arab world. His arguments are very solid. The guy is very balanced, and you can see, like, he's not buffling, you know. He is really talking solid arguments when it comes to the interviews, especially by hostile mainstream media. And a lot of mainstream media outlets, they try to discredit him, try to portray him as some sort of a crazy person. But it was a counterproductive for them, because if someone from the mainstream media sends a journalist to Syria to interview Assad, they're not sending him to interview him. They're sending someone to trap him. And if you watch tens of interviews of Assad in the past 10 years, the guy never made any mistake, like, for example, Saddam Hussein used to do. Saddam Hussein was an emotional guy. You feel like he's making angry statements. I will bomb this country. I will kill that person. He's a completely different character, Assad. And even among the Arab presidents or the officials nowadays, I don't think there is a president who can talk English and express himself in English the way he does. However, because the Syria doesn't fit in the liberal democracy that the West wants to export into Syria. And when I say liberal democracy, it's not only about the hierarchy of the political system. It's about also lifestyle. It's about the economic system. They want to make Syria some sort of a consuming country. Like, it doesn't produce, it doesn't make any its own products. They want it to be a vassal state. It's like just consuming the Western products and not producing anything. So all these efforts in order to topple the government is not only about to change of a behavior, but also gaining 24 million people of market in Syria. And not only that, there is a gas in the Mediterranean that we're finding nowadays, and Syria is in the crossroad of the Silk Road. There are a lot of things that we need to think about. So to simplify things to the people, they're not going to, of course, explain this policy objectives to the people, right? They simplify things. They try to portray him, this evil person who is gassing his own people, and he is murdering babies. That is why they have funded tens of so-called journalists in Syria and political activists. Why would Britain pay tens of millions on media projects in Syria? Do they care about the truth or to manufacture a new reality, which is the opposite of the real reality, right? So it's a really complicated a war. It has different dimensions, and I mean, fortunately, Syria, like, they defeated the regime change war from the geopolitical and military perspectives, but Syria is now in a very dire and difficult situation, and the people are living in very hard conditions. And the issue of the electricity, the heating and the gas and the energy resources. So they're trying to suffocate the people now for their choice. Like, because they stood with the government and they elected the government, they're trying to suffocate the people. And I will tell you where I'm going with this. Now the people in Syria, I mean, if I'm living in Syria and I'm living like 20 hours without an electricity and my food has gone, like, you can't even keep your food in the fridge, And the salaries are, because of the dollar and Syrian lira exchange, has become like very weak. I will not really go and try to explain myself what the imperialists did, because I need to feed my children, I need to feed my son, I need to feed my family. So I start to blame the government. And this is what the imperialists are aiming to. Of course, the people are blaming the government partially, and they're criticizing the government. So like the criticism on social media, if you read Arabic, it's enormous. And it's if there is a dictatorship, these people would be now, the prisons would be filled with people. And it's not only criticism against the government. There, like 2 days ago, I criticized Assad's decision to appoint the prime minister, because he appointed a new the prime minister who was the same previously, and I criticized that. And if there is a brutal dictatorship in Syria, I would not do that in public on Facebook, because I would think about my return to Syria. Because if it's a brutal dictatorship, my name would be on the borders, and then they will just take me to the prison right away without even investigation about it, right? But we say in Arabic, the roof of the criticism is very high now in Syria. And the government is not really intervening. They just, because the people also need to express themselves. Otherwise, they will explode from anger. And they have the right to talk about these issues. They have the right to criticize the government. But at the same time, they have also to understand that this situation that we are in, we would have never been in such a situation were it not for this regime change war. Because I remember very well in 2010 and 2011, before the war, and 10 years before that, the situation in Syria was close to perfect.
Yeah, the sanctions aspect of this is always something I harp on, that this is what U.S. sanctions are designed to do. And you have U.S. documentation that lays this out. You drive people to desperation. So they basically, your child is starving in front of you at some point. Who cares who's making this happen? I need to stop, right? And that's the ultimate goal. That's kind of why I point out that you Americans are under U.S. sanctions themselves today. But what's crazy to me is that they create the very situation they then turn around and point to and say, look at how terrible it is over there. Look at what Assad doing when their sanctions are literally on its face creating it. And that's one of the points of why they name this person a dictator, a brutal dictator killing his own people while they're driving that to take place. So let's jump over to Vanessa. What are your thoughts on that, and why do you think it's dishonest?
I think it's beyond dishonest. I think it's, again, part of this, let's reduce the argument down, as Kivork said, to bad dictator, good rebels, and keep it simple. Because if we allow it to get into a full-blown debate, people will start to understand the nuance, the complexities, right? And, you know, it's ridiculous to say that people can't criticize the government. I mean, I probably spend 12 hours per day listening to people criticizing the government, from the taxi driver to the guy in the kiosk to virtually anyone I speak to. Generally, it's done with humor. I mean, Syrians have a great sense of humor. But to say that people are not allowed to criticize the government is crazy, as Kivork pointed out. And I'm sure Eva will also agree with me. And I want to pass on to this Orientalism aspect also, because the majority of the pundits that are regurgitating and parroting the CIA MI6 talking points have never spent, or if they have come at all, extended time in the Middle East, but particularly in Syria. Now, in Syria, and I'd be really interested if Kivork agrees with what I've seen, the majority of the society is, if you look at a Syrian family, it's patriarchal. This means that the father is the focal point of that family, whether it's Christian, whether it's Druze, whether it's Sunni, whether it's Alawite, it doesn't matter, right? The father is the focal point. And the kids can fall out with the father. The kids can have arguments with the father. The kids can have difference of opinions with the father. But ultimately, if they're in trouble or if they need help, they'll go to the father, right? That's Syrian communities. That's Syrian society. And that, for me, extends to the relationship of the Syrian people with their president, right? I've interviewed people who have literally cussed the president because they don't have electricity, they don't have water. And I'm not prevented, by the way, from talking to those people or listening to their complaints. But I can guarantee, even if they rant for 5 or 10 minutes, at the end of that, they will always say, God bless the president, God bless him, God keep him, you know, and immediately they will become like the child that is complaining to the father, because ultimately they know that they turn to him when they need help. That's the bottom line, right? So this Orientalist position that this is a brutal dictator totally denies the cultural differences in the Middle East to the West, but particularly inside Syria, right? That's number one. The other thing, and I want to come to this President Assad and his interviews, and I want to give an example. I'll not name any names because this was told to me privately. But there was an interview where the journalist, the Western journalist, was deliberately attempting to trap the president. And the person who had arranged that interview was in the room. And at one point, that journalist took out a photo of Omran, the whole story that was then later debunked, because he wanted to trap the president. At that time, we had CNN anchors in crocodile tears and all the rest of it over Omran, right? The person who'd arranged the interview was shocked because this wasn't part of, this hadn't been discussed prior to the interview. So he tried to intervene. And the president held his hand up. He said, it's fine. I can answer this. There's absolutely no problem. And show me one single Western politician or diplomat that would be that open to discussing something he wasn't even prepared to discuss, and something that was controversial and at the time was being used to paint him in the brutal dictator light, right? This is the difference. You know, if you speak to Bashar al-Jafri, if you speak to any of the, let's say, high-level diplomats and politicians that form the close contingent around the presidency, they will all address talking points. They will all address them openly, factually, with evidence, but they're ignored. You know, Eva will tell you from her interview with Bashar al-Jafri, he has his microphone cut. He has deliberately bad interpreters translating what he's saying because they don't want these people to be heard because they're speaking sense, right? So these pundits who are basically acting as gatekeepers, effectively, because they're preventing the complexity, the nuances, the real information from on the ground and from Syrians. They're preventing it being heard, which would inform and educate their audiences far better than just throwaway statements that he's a brutal dictator or he's committed abuses or. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, gatekeeper is a perfect word for that. Exactly.
Yeah.
Eva, what, you have thoughts on the topic?
Yeah, I'll add on to what Vanessa was saying about in the United Nations when Dr. Jafri was the permanent representative for Syria to the UN. He was numerous times cut off. His mic was cut. He said one time, if I recall correctly, it would have been, I believe, at a time when a U.S. delegation had come back from Syria after observing the 2014 elections. And he was just in the midst of introducing them. Then mic was cut. And he said something to the effect, I believe, like, fortunately, there were independent recording, so we have their voices. But, you know, why was my mic cut? Why were their voices being prevented from being heard? Clearly, it was because they were going to talk about their findings in being in Syria during the elections. And that would horribly contradict the mainstream narrative. But he also mentioned that happened to Walid Mualim, the former foreign minister, correct? And he was, I don't remember if this is in New York or Geneva, but anyway, the point being, he's a high up representative, and the UN was trying to force him to wrap it up in 5 minutes or something. And he was firm may his soul rest in peace, he was firm. And he said, you know, I came here to talk about my country, and you're not going to silence me. So he held his ground, and he was able to make his point. But I mean, that does show that clearly there's an agenda to silence Syrian voices. If they're not being silenced, they're being mocked or called any number of names. I liked that story Vanessa told about Amran, and although this is not about a Syrian representative, Christiane Amanpour did that to Sergei Lavrov, also popping the Amran photo without that having been on the list of questions that was supposed to be discussed. And he likewise is a very good diplomat and handled the question. I mean, her question to him was like, is this boy a terrorist or something? And he's like, clearly he's not. But about that issue, you know, I will just say, you know, that issue, Amran, for people who don't know, his adorable face sitting in an ambulance was plastered on newspapers around the world about 1 month after Abdul Issa was brutally beheaded by terrorist factions by Nuruddin Azinki. And the photographer who took the famous photo of Amran was friends with the terrorist of the Zinki faction that beheaded Abdul Issa. And I happened to be in Syria, and then Vanessa went to Aleppo afterwards. And to my knowledge, I don't think there are any other Western journalists, although they have gone to Syria, and although Kvork has mentioned many times in interviews, they are issued visas. It's not like they're not in Syria. It's not like they're not able to go to Aleppo or meet this family or follow up on the story. I don't believe that any others have followed up on that story, because that story, along with this whole narrative of President Assad being an evil dictator, those stories and those concepts, and then the amplifying of these unknown sources, these activist sources in quote-unquote rebel-held areas, all of this, of course, and the complete erasing of the vast majority of Syrians who would have a lot of things to say about how Syria was, like Kvork was saying, before the war, and about their suffering. All this combined, of course, is a perfect recipe for an attempt at regime change. And so that's why, primarily, you have these evil dictators, you have these chemical hoax stories again and again. It's to save the Syrian people from this supposed madman, as you were all saying, when clearly, if you've spent any time in Syria, not even, you don't necessarily even have to be in Syria, but I mean, ideally, it would be better if you do go and actually talk to Syrians in Syria. You can find Syrians in Lebanon, in Canada, in my travels and airports, I've encountered Syrians. And when they've seen, maybe because I've seen some Syrian flag or something that I have on my laptop or something, and we get into a conversation, inevitably most Syrians I've met have spoken glowingly of their country and their president. But certainly if you go to Syria, you'll hear the horrible, miserable stories of suffering, but you'll also hear, oh, did you come to Syria before 2011? No, sorry, not till 2014. Oh, you should have seen Syria before 2011. It was paradise. And they'll talk about how safe it was and how people could afford to go out, how just all the things that they can't do now. Vanessa can speak at great length about how the sanctions are impacting on ordinary Syrians. I spent half of last year and a couple of weeks this year in Syria. And I was surprised at the change in prices, at the skyrocketing of the Syrian pound. Even last year, when I went back just for a couple of weeks at election time this year, just one simple, maybe seemingly trite example, but, you know, a bag of hummus, which you can buy at a local chickpea hummus store, used to cost something like £400. And this time it was £2,200. And as a foreigner with US dollars on me, okay, I can afford that. But think about the average Syrian who earns pounds per month. And this is just a bag of hummus, right? I mean, and then just they can't afford to live now because of these sanctions. So I've kind of waffled, but that does all tie back into the whole concept of all these talking points, the dictator, the police state, talking points that many of these pundits feel the need to put out there, when some of them actually went to Syria albeit for a very limited amount of time, and it didn't go very far, but nonetheless, they went there, they were able to broadcast from there, and yet they have the gall to call it a police state.
Right. I mean, the one main point that stands out to me in what you just described, if this is the case and it's that obvious, why would things need to be made up? right? Which, by the way, we can prove multiple directions why there's multiple things that have been completely fabricated. So why would that be necessary if this is such an obvious case? I mean, that's something easy to point out for people. Well, let's go ahead and finish off with the discussion of, well, really, the OPCW topic came to mind in regard to how this is being applied, where it seems like it's an interesting, it's a topic that's continuing to be hammered in. To make it, in my opinion, almost to make it seem as if there is an, you know, we're fighting for the Syrian people, while at the same time, that's not really leading to the real truth behind it, which you guys are all describing. And maybe if you could touch on that, and we can just kind of finish with your thoughts on where this may be going and what the objective may be for people trying to misrepresent the information and, you know, what you're doing to try to stop that. Why don't we start with Eva and we'll finish off here.
All right. Well, I'll keep mine brief. Vanessa was in Syria. I believe you were in Syria, Vanessa, when the actual alleged chemical attack occurred. And certainly Vanessa was among the first non-Syrian journalists to go to Douma and to speak with civilians and to hear narratives from the hospital or the medical point that was featured in the footage put out by White Helmets and allies. Alleging that there had been a chemical attack. I went, I'd have to go through my notes. I went at the end of April, I think it was, so a couple of weeks after all of that. And I also went to the same point and I talked with medical staff who made very clear that they hadn't treated anyone that had been exposed to a chemical agent. So you had other people, you had the German media, whose name eludes me, but Menace and Kvork can fill that in. You had Robert Fisk. You had One American News. You had all these people both contradicting the narratives that were being put out in corporate media based on, you know, again, these unnamed sources, the White Helmets. And at the same time, you had people going to the place in question and getting video testimonies of people saying, no, this didn't happen. But on top of that, then you, I saw some of them. I know Vanessa and also Sharmeen Nirwani, another fantastic journalist who's from the very early on in the war on Syria has been writing truth and was badly smeared for taking a very principled stance on Syria. We all saw labs that were used to manufacture chemicals, whether or not they were used to manufacture chemical weapons, I can't say, but certainly there were, and Vanessa can speak more to this, there were many of these types of labs in areas where terrorists had a presence or headquarters. But on the other hand, I think, again, I kind of touched on this earlier on, the predominant thing I was hearing when I was in not only Douma, but surrounding areas, was just how immensely civilians had suffered under the rule of, again, Jaish al-Islam, Fayyad al-Rahman, and the other terrorist factions. And they emphasized that they had been starved by these groups. Now, Eastern Ghouta is an agricultural region, so it's like, well, you know, what about your agricultural fields? Couldn't you grow things? No. These terrorist factions had control of the fields. They had control over any of the aid that was sent into these regions, just like in Madaya, just like Aleppo, et cetera, before. So they're the main points they wanted to me to, you know, take away and tell people about were how they'd been not only starved, but tortured, like literally tortured, imprisoned by terrorists, how terrorists had committed public executions in the middle of the, in central squares, in broad daylight, in public view. And, you know, these things, again, with all the hype over Douma, aside from media that were actually willing to hear these voices and hear, take these testimonies and try to tell people outside of Syria about them, I didn't see many others in alternative media doing that. And so I think that, again, choosing to now, 3 years after the fact, highlight, okay, this chemical attack didn't take place because of this and this, this investigator, the OPCW investigators that have spoken out. That is good. That is commendable to finally speak out about that. But what about the things that Syrians really also want you to know about? So I don't know, Ryan, if you mind bringing yourself back in. So I think that I'll let you and others address perhaps the nature of why this is being hammered home so much. This Douma was a false chemical, it was a chemical hoax. But the fact is, this has been known for years. The Syrian journalists reported on it first. They were discarded. They were mocked. I believe it was 16 or 17 Syrians from Douma went to The Hague to give their testimonies. They were mocked. They were called obscene. It was a masquerade, even though these were people, including the boy Hassan Diab himself, who featured in the film being hosed down, allegedly being treated for a chemical agent. And then, of course, numerous journalists, non-Syrian journalists, went there and took testimonies and were disregarded. So I would say, you know, it's good that people have come late to the party to talk about this issue. It isn't the only issue in Syria. And there are some who have even had the audacity to say, okay, Duma was staged, but the others probably really happened, which is just ridiculous. I mean, if you can admit that this one particular one was staged, why in the world would you think that any of the other alleged chemical attacks or the other allegations at all of massacres were actually legitimate?
Right. And this is the point from earlier saying, you know, there's more to this conversation, but he's definitely an evil dictator. It's kind of just a half point that really allows you to look like you're trying to be objective in a very, very objective way. It's dishonest on its face, in my opinion. Excellent points. Vanessa Bealey, would you like to jump in next?
Look, I think, first of all, I just want to point out, you know, these pundits who are effectively disappearing through the narratives they are amplifying, they are disappearing much of the suffering of the Syrian people. For example, today was the start of the massacres in the Latakia countryside, where I struggle to actually even talk about the atrocities that were committed, but pregnant women were massacred, children were kidnapped, all manner of heinous, depraved crimes were carried out during this massacre. And yet, as I say, it's barely been talked about or mentioned in Western media. And certainly, I can almost guarantee that none of these pundits will even realize what today is or what today means to the majority of the Syrian people, particularly those people in the Latakia countryside who suffered at the hands of the so-called Free Syrian Army, the so-called moderate rebels that were being trained and equipped by Obama and the CIA, of course, at that time. But if these people and these pundits can accept that the OPCW was a staged event, that it was a propaganda exercise carried out by UK Foreign Office funded and promoted armed groups and the White Helmet auxiliaries. If they can accept that as being reality, then why aren't they looking behind the curtain, as Eva said, at the other narratives? The other narratives, we know that the chemical weapon narrative has been, you know, the weapons of mass destruction. It's maintained the war against Syria, but it's not the only narrative that's maintained the war against Syria. The brutal dictator, the Hitlerization of President Assad, the claim of political prisoners, the millions of documents that CIJA, that I can't remember what it stands for right this second, claim they have in a secret vault showing episodes of torture, etc. The Caesar report. All of these events and reports are questionable, but they're not questioning them. They're only questioning the one that effectively, if you like, is being sanctified by the fact that it is actual OPCW inspectors that are exposing the corruption at the OPCW and revealing the fact that the report was doctored retrospectively to retrospectively provide a pretext for the unlawful aggression carried out by the UK, France, and US against Syria. But somehow it stops there. It's just like they don't start to question, well, okay, if the mainstay narrative in Syria against Syria, the chemical weapons, has been exposed to be fake, and the OPCW is shown to be corrupted and heavily compromised, then perhaps we should start looking at the other headline captions on Syria and seeing what the truth is about them. But they haven't done that. And actually, even when they are challenged publicly, they withdraw. They don't provide the evidence upon which they are basing their opinions.
my belief is they don't provide the evidence upon which they're basing their opinions, because they know perfectly well the only evidence they can provide is from the New York Times or the BBC or CNN or Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, all of which are corrupt, compromised instruments of imperialist power. So that's my belief, why they don't want to come forward with the actual evidence to back up their claims. But by not doing that, they are not providing journalism. They're not informing their audience. You don't make a statement that you can't back up. James Corbett doesn't make statements that he can't back up with reams of research and links and information and opinion. But they're failing in providing that service to their audience.
Yep, completely agree. And whether it's intentional or not, as you said, it's what I would call a limited hangout. And that's exactly what that's designed to do, is make it appear as if you're digging up the entire picture when really all you're doing is making sure people don't go past a certain point. And that's not about finding the truth. Kevork, you want to finish us off?
Actually, both points, the brutal dictatorship and the chemical attacks in Syria, are interconnected. We cannot really separate between them. And from this point of view, when you try to sell that the leadership in Syria is just an insane and they're just a brutal dictatorship that can, you should expect anything from them. And then when you draw the so-called red line of Obama and you say, if he crosses this red line, then we will act accordingly. And when a chemical alleged attack happens in Syria and you accuse the government for that, some of the people will buy these allegations, because you have been already selling the propaganda that the Assad is Hitler of the 21st century for 3 years. And the first chemical attack that happened was against the Syrian government forces, actually in Aleppo in 2012. And the in Khan al-Assad. The second one was in Eastern Ghouta in 2013, and they accused the Syrian government for that, and then Khan Sheikhoun, and lately in Douma. So if the administration of the OPCW is compromised during and after the Douma investigations. I'm talking about only the administration, because the researchers have conducted their job. If this happened in 2018, why do you think it didn't happen in Khan Sheikhoun or in previously in Eastern Ghouta? So there is an American role in this, and the Americans weighed in with the OPCW administration, and they tried to change the final findings of the OPCW. So all this chronology of the events that started in 2013, when Obama he drew the so-called red line, and then only a few months later, an attack happens in Eastern Ghouta. I mean, politically speaking, look, I'm not a technician. I'm not a chemical scientist. I'm not analyzing the actual event of the chemical alleged attack, but rather the politics behind it, right? We're able to read these events. So when you think that Assad is an insane person, you will also believe that he is using chemical weapons against civilians that have no actual military weight. There is nothing productive in bombing civilians with the chemical weapons, with no military means, with no military goals behind that, right? And the same thing applies in Douma in 2018, which was the most obvious of it, when the entire Eastern Ghouta was liberated, and then just a small faction from Douma was still in the hands of Jaish al-Islam, and it was like an island surrounded by Syrian army and the Russian air force, and the allies were there. It was just a matter of time for this geography to fall in the hands of the Syrian government. And if any observer of the Syrian war who can read maps, like there are websites that you can see the map of control over Syria. And when you know how the Syrian government like functioned in the past 10 years and how they try to encircle the enemy and cut all the reinforcement for this area to be forced to surrender, and they bust them to Idlib without fighting. And when you see that this pattern is repeating, and it happened in Douma, it was just a matter for me 2 weeks for Douma to fall in the hands of the Syrian government, and all of a sudden alleged chemical attack happens. It was pretty obvious that was orchestrated by the White Helmets and Jaish al-Islam, and it was conducted against 49 civilians, right? 49 civilians died. So why would if a government wants to use chlorine gas on any target, they calculate the military objectives of that, right? But as I mentioned, because of the propaganda that Assad is an insane person, and secondly, because of the Orientalist view and the racist view that these people are just barbarians, they don't understand any military techniques or strategies, that's how you combine all these factors and you say, Assad has bombed his people with a chemical weapon, and you will find people just repeating that on social media and on mainstream media. And in my opinion, if Goebbels was alive today, he would be very proud of the mainstream media and the people behind the mainstream media and how they repeated the lies until it has become their distorted truth about the matter, and they sold it to their people. But serious people, clear-minded people, they understand clearly the role of the intelligence agency, and especially the Turkish role in this regard, especially in Eastern Ghouta in 2013 and later in Douma in 2018. And Simer Hirsch addressed this issue. I think the title of his article was The Red Line and the Rat Line. So if you want to dig in and understand these issues, the materials are public and you can reach to your opinion. But if you want to just read the titles on titles of the articles, of course a person will stay very ignorant. And we can see nowadays what's happening, especially after the corona crisis, and how it was very easy to wage like psychological warfare against the people in order for them to accept concessions and agree with the new status quo, which they call it the Great Reset.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's about taking personal responsibility for your information and listening to alternative perspectives, which is one of the main things I hope people can recognize today, is that at the very least, these are three experts we have here today that are giving you a different perspective that is not being allowed in the mainstream conversation, which seems to include a lot of the independent media today. It's very frustrating that that's happening. And so thank you all three of you for being here today, taking the time to walk us through things that hope people should have already known 10 times over by now. But thank you for doing it again with us today so we can help get this through and help, you know, counterbalance the misinformation out there. Anybody would like to leave anything with us on the way out here, please go ahead and make some comments, and then we'll wrap it up today.
No, just thanks so much for having us all on and giving us a platform to speak these truths.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah, really appreciate it, Ryan. You're always so solid at countering all of the destructive narratives on almost every subject. I'm in awe of you, but thank you very much for providing the platform and having us all on.
Thank you very much, Ryan. It was really a pleasure, and I hope our insights would be beneficial for your audience as well, and hopefully to be your guest again soon.
Absolutely. And thank you, all three of you. It's always an honor to have you on. And as always, everybody out there, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.